Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. Last Wednesday, as you know, 18-year-old Barnard College freshman Tessa Majors was fatally stabbed in Morningside Park near the Columbia and Barnard campuses. The high-profile murder has put pressure on the NYPD to act quickly in identifying, well, they've identified somebody, three teenage boys, two of whom are 13 and 14 years old, as alleged suspects, and we say suspects, not perpetrators at this point. For some New Yorkers, the tragic case conjures memories of the Central Park Five, teens, some also 14 at the time, when they were accused of Tricia Mailey's murder 3 decades ago. The city is, of course, far safer than it was back then, but criminal justice reform, some of which have just begun to go into effect, like the decriminalization of marijuana and next year's coming bail reforms, have already received pushback among people who think the only way to lower crime is through the enforcement of tougher laws. A rise in murders this year, and now Tessa Majors' murder, are sure to amplify concerns over justice reform measures. So how will New York City institutions, from the police department to news media outlets, approach this year's rise in murders, and how should they? Joining me now are Harry Siegel, co-host of the New York Politics podcast, FAQ NYC. He's a Daily News columnist and Daily Beast senior editor. And Christina Greer, the other FAQ NYC host with Harry Siegel, and associate professor of political science at Fordham. Hi, Harry. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having us.
And we're getting Christina's cell phone hooked up. She's out of the country, even though she definitely wanted to participate in this conversation. I guess we're having trouble with her cell phone at the moment. But Harry, before we get into the facts of the individual case, remind us of the context that crime in New York City has gone up a little bit this year, or at least shootings and murders.
There were 298 murders last year, which was the second consecutive year with less than 300 murders, after about 60 years with more than 300 murders prior to that. This year, there'd been, as of a couple days ago, and counting Majors, 303 year-to-date. So that's about a 9% rise. So for a certain stop clock set, this is the bad old days are inevitably back, and that includes the New York Post, former Giuliani Commissioner Bernie Kerik, and others. The other thing motivating them and the police unions, including Ed Mullins, who had a pretty vicious statement about the murder that went ahead of what any other police sources have been saying and said Majors was looking for weed and sort of brought her death upon herself.
Just by going into a park to buy some marijuana. Talk about victim shaming.
And in fact, no other on-the-record police sources are backing that account, and several are saying that that is not correct. But this is all happening as more criminal justice reforms, and fairly significant ones, are coming next year, mostly bail reform and discovery reform that more or less ends cash bail and means prosecutors have to turn over information much more quickly. So the forces of reaction, and Bill Barr, the attorney general, by the way, has a op-ed in the New York Post today talking about how we need much more reverence for police and authority or, doom is upon us, are very eager to say, look how bad things already are, and it's about to get terrifying. And sadly, I think that they've taken this really tragic murder and very rapidly politicized it to warn of what the effects of these reforms might be before they're even implemented. I have some concerns about these reforms, but I can't say anything before any of this has actually happened. They're already announcing that blood is running in the streets. And honestly, a young, attractive white girl who's new to New York, who's maybe a jogger in some news reports, but was certainly wearing running shoes, resonates in some really powerful ways. Going back to the Central Park jogger who wasn't murdered but was raped and robbed and left unconscious by the reservoir in Central Park.
Christina, I think we have you. Do we? Are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Brian. Hi, Harry.
Hi. You can jump in anywhere on what Harry said. One thing that I'm thinking about in addition is that there have been 303 murders in New York City this year, and I don't know if the average listener could name another individual victim. And here is, you know, again, the selective outrage or fear being generated by a young white blonde girl. Nothing against her. She's a totally innocent victim, and this is a horrible, awful, disgusting thing that happened. But how come we know Tessa Majors, and who are those other 302 people?
I think I agree with you completely, Brian. I mean, first things first, this is a tragedy, and it's, I think, every parent's incredible nightmare. And, you know, I used to live next to that park for about 20 years. And so it's gotten better. However, it's still, you know, it's some drug, open air drug usage at different times. And so what's really worrying and troublesome to me is that, you know, there, even though New York has almost 9 million people and our crime is incredibly low compared to other cities, I really fear that this incident, because, as Harry mentioned, the demographics of it, a young, white, blonde girl, will really give the police department and also certain elected officials carte blanche to say, you know what, crime is rampant, and this is the bad old days of the 1980s, 19 New York, 1980s Harlem, and so let's hyper-police and start going into neighborhoods, especially particular neighborhoods, and cracking skulls. And so because we can't name so many victims that have succumbed to violent crime in New York, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that certain murders get more attention than others? And, you know, obviously there's certain people in this community who have been ringing the alarm about, you know, low-level muggings, low-level offenses, and they've gotten zero attention. And so now we're at a point where it will get attention, but what kind is what really worries me.
And listeners, we can take your phone calls with your thoughts or questions about anything having to do with the murder of Tessa Majors or the larger context of New York City at this moment. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Harry Siegel and Christina Greer, co-host of the New York Politics Podcast, FAQ NYC. Harry, also a Daily News columnist. Christina, also professor of political science at Fordham. Harry, did you want to just continue on that? Your face looked like you did.
Just one other thing to mention there is that this happened in a public park. And that's something that resonates in all sorts of different cross sections of the city. And this is a small park. It's 30 acres. It had the most robberies of any park. You know, Central Park is 900 for some context in the city. And so when people think about public commons, this plays a big role. And I wonder about Columbia, which has at some points warned students not to go to the park or to go there after dark. And if Columbia, excuse me,
yeah, that's okay.
They've had decades and they have tens of billions of dollars endowment to get whites there to play some role in that park, as opposed to saying this is the end of our sphere. Once you go outside that wall, you should watch out. And I don't believe that they've done that or participated in the life of Harlem, since they say they're Morningside Heights and use this natural cliff in certain ways to buffer themselves from the neighborhood and the city that surrounds them.
Surprising to me, just as a matter of public relations, that the university wouldn't have taken more of an active role in sort of, and maybe they would have been pushed back against this, privatizing security in that park to some degree as a de facto extension of campus, where there are people who come there from all over the country to study, you know, will go on a regular basis. And Christina, that's other potential fallout from this for New York. I've already heard from a friend who has, I guess, my mother was telling me last night about a friend of hers who has a college-age daughter, and they don't live in New York, and thinking about New York, and that would be great. Oh, boy, Columbia or NYU or something living in New York, and all of a sudden they hear this story, and I don't know about New York.
Right. Well, I mean, Columbia and the University of Pennsylvania have always had to overcome this reputation of being, you know, of the eight Ivies, they were the two that were sort of, you know, in the quote unquote ghetto for so long. And that really prevented a lot of families from wanting to send their children there. Hence, Columbia really playing up Morningside Heights as opposed to Harlem. I mean, I think we also have to think back on these town gown relations. You know, in the 1960s, when Columbia was thinking about building their gym facilities, you know, in that park. And the reason why it was, you know, the community fought back and there were lots of black students who, you know, had protests and sit-ins because Columbia wanted to essentially allow, you know, residents, community residents to use the facilities, but only through essentially a poor door. And because there's pushback from that, you know, we know Columbia built facilities elsewhere and then expanded northward. And so there's a long history of Columbia being in New York, but not of New York, and being in Harlem, but not necessarily, you know, incorporating their students into the community in a robust way. I mean, I got my PhD from Columbia. I was on campus for several years, and there were so many times where there are these invisible boundaries and invisible gates and walls where members of the community, quite frankly, didn't feel comfortable ever coming on campus, even though they could. And there's this reputation of, you know, we are in a sacred space, but, you know, those people over there are those people. And so without, I think, proper education and real robust community relationships, we have, I think, misinformation and a certain lack of trust on both ends from the community members and also the university, where this should be a conversation. I mean, I also think it's really important to remember this is December and college campuses across the country always experience a slight uptick in crime around finals time because students are coming from libraries late at night with laptops, and this is the time for people to get mugged and robbed. It was always pretty common when I was in college and graduate school. And so this unfortunate tragic incident, because that park is so dark, because it has so many nooks and crannies, because it isn't fully a non-drug usage park. I mean, they have a dog park there. They've got, you know, children's swings. But we also have to recognize the great inequality that still exists in the city. And there are a lot of people who see Columbia as this crown jewel of privilege. And there's a lack of relationship building that I think has occurred. And unfortunately, it results in sort of big incidents every so often. But we have to ask ourselves, mm-hmm. what is the responsibility of a university that gets, you know, tax credits and that uses so many resources of the city, but isn't necessarily educating all of its community members about what else is going on outside of their gates?
Pamela in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. I want to change the subject a little bit.
Don't change it too
I'm
much.
I'm really concerned at the possibility that the boys who committed the murder, and I'm not going to argue that it was terrible, are going to be charged as adults. And as a former head of middle school, I can say in my experience that this is not an age where a real understanding of cause and effect and so on is clear to them. We're one of two states, and I know the law got modified a few years ago, but for murder, it still allows them to be charged. So I have a concern about the appropriateness of that kind of charge. And I also volunteer in New York State correctional facilities, mm-hmm. and so I have met some of the people who have been charged as adults, as 16-year-olds, and it doesn't, prison is not a suitable place for children.
Right. Pamela, thank you so much, and that is certainly not changing the subject at all. That is the subject. Harry, do you want to weigh in on this? You reported in your column on Sunday some of how these teenage suspects might be treated by the system today and how that might be different from in the Central Park 5 days.
So there's three teenagers here. One is 13, one is 14. The other is either 14 or 16, depending on the news report. We'll see how this plays out. Already we've seen some significant differences from how this has played out previously. The 13-year-old who has allegedly confessed to a role in the robbery, was questioned with his uncle and guardian present the entire time. So not we're taping at the end and someone is there, someone is in and out. That's a pretty clear and obvious difference. The 14-year-old who had been in police custody was released, evidently at the direction of the Manhattan district attorney, who said that this case isn't strong enough yet and you can't just hold someone. I do think that in this reform moment that there seemed to be, and with Raise the Age around, some real lessons learned about how this should play out. I'd note that those reforms often lead over time to backlashes. And as a 12-year-old or 14-year-old does a terrible thing, in Donald Trump's open letter to New York right after the Central Park attack, this is one of the points he brings up, is these kids are laughing because they know, and this was completely untrue as it played out, they were held for 2 years before their trial and then given long prison sentences as adults. But he said these kids are laughing because they know there's no consequences and they'll be out and able to do violence and cause damage to decent New Yorkers again. And that is another of those perennial arguments worth taking care of, worth considering. Like, there's a reason that the Post and others come back to that. And most people, however broadly sympathetic to 13-year-olds they are, and I think you're absolutely right, caller, that they're not adults and they can't be treated the same way, at a certain point say, I just want to be safe. And the thought of a random, very young person attacking and killing makes them sad, and they also want to be separated from those children. So it's an interesting balance. We seem to have really moved toward the reform side. We'll see as this case plays out how far that goes.
And the randomness that you mentioned is another reason that I think, besides the so-called worthiness of the victim in traditional terms, that people are so freaked out by this and it's getting so much attention. If the city has become such a safer place, which it has, it's not that there aren't any murders, but most of those murders, the vast majority of those murders, are between people who know each other.
And you have 700,000 college students here. That's more than the population of Baltimore or I think Philadelphia now.
Huh.
And so you're looking at maybe a million parents around the country in any year for kids not like, you know, who aren't native New Yorkers, who are thinking about this. So this becomes a story, the sort of random street crime that resonates nationally and even internationally in ways that others would not. Because these are the new arrivals in New York and the fresh eyes and the people who are supposed to be in certain ways like immigrants replenishing our city.
Nicola in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicola.
Hi, Brian. I currently live in Harlem, but I grew up close to that park, mm-hmm. and my daughter is now a student at Barnard. So she has walked through that park. I didn't know this, but she recently told me, yes, I've walked through that park. It's really peaceful. But what she's worried about is that school safety at Barnard will use this as an opportunity to harass the black students on campus. Now, I reassured her that why would they do that? They would have to answer to the parents. But after what happened recently at Barnard with a Columbia black male student, they're worried. The black students are worried now.
Christina, yeah. Any thought?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, first of all, we already have our governor, you know, allocating 500 police officers for the MTA, uninvited, unannounced. We had our mayor, you know, sort of acquiescing to the police department and giving them even more police officers than they wanted. I was harassed several times when I was a Columbia student getting my PhD because there's an assumption that black students don't belong. I mean, this is a much larger, longer conversation about, you know, I always joke with my colleagues about, you know, historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs such as Howard University and Spelman and Morehouse. And I always tell them, well, I went to an HWCU, which is a historically white college, right? Which is set up intentionally for the production of white knowledge and excellence. And there was always this assumption that I didn't belong there. And I, you know, and I'm a female, not even a male student. And we know that black faculty were harassed and still get harassed by, you know, police officers in the area. So I think that that's a very real concern. I mean, I think, you know, going back to Pamela's point, the first caller, you know, this is something where we have to remember these demographics are real. We have three allegedly black boys who have committed this crime against a white female. This goes back to the old stereotypical horrific tropes of American society that date back 400 years. I mean, I do think that, you know, if we're being real about this, if this were a black Barnard student, the level of attention and the front page papers just would not be the same. The tragedy would still be the same, and I'm not devaluing the life of Tessa Majors at all. And I really, you know, I think all of us feel for her family and her entire community in Virginia and at Barnard. But I do think that the racial composition, even with a progressive mayor, needs to be addressed, because I think there is a level of fear among students across all college campuses. Because keep in mind, this is going to resonate not just at Columbia and Barnard, but across universities in the United States. And we know for a fact that Black students consistently get harassed by police officers and campus security when they are just trying to go to the library and get an education. And so during finals week, this is an added level of pressure of students of color across the country in a fear for their safety, which oftentimes isn't discussed or addressed.
I want to get into the police politics of this. On Sunday, Sergeants Benevolent Association President Ed Mullins told radio host John Katsimatidis on the air that Tessa Majors went to Morningside Park, where she was killed, in order to buy marijuana. He brought it up, this head of the Sergeants Union, whether it's a true fact or not. But let's take a listen to a little bit of it, under a minute, of what Mullins said, and then we'll talk about why it matters.
What I'm understanding is she was in the park to buy marijuana. And you think about that we don't enforce marijuana laws anymore. We're basically hands off on the enforcement of marijuana. So here we have a student murdered by a 13-year-old, and we have a common denominator of marijuana. You know, my question to the people in New York City is, why is this happening? You know, where is the parents of this 13-year-old? Where is his upbringing? Where is his school? Where is the moral values? And how is that allowed to occur? And why are we accepting a hands-off policy for enforcement of marijuana when we just see a young girl with a bright future from a good family, her life taken away by a 13-year-old in a park which isn't safe to begin with?
So that's Sergeants Benevolent Association President Ed Mullins on the John Katsimatidis radio show on Sunday. Mayor de Blasio responded to that on New York One last night. Here's a minute of the mayor.
Cities all over the country, states that have legalized marijuana, including some really big cities, Denver, Seattle, more and more the California cities now, as they have had more experience with legalization. There's no indication of an uptick in crime. In fact, one of the things we've talked about all along, and I do believe in marijuana legalization, put out a plan for how we can do it safely and appropriately. But one of the things that's true is you focus more and more police attention on the truly violent people in our society. You can take down gangs more. You can really get at the root of the violence. One of the things Bill Bratton said this to me years ago, and it was striking, that in this city of 8.6 million people, there's a few thousand people responsible for most of the violence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where the NYPD has increasingly put its resources. You know, not on low-level nonviolent offenses, but where the real action is. And so I don't even know why Mullins, I agree with you, I don't even know why he's trying that attack line, but it was heartless, and it was, again, unfortunately, about a political agenda.
Harry, what do you think the political agenda is?
Ed Mullins speaks for the police unions, who are actually a little different from the police leadership. But in effect, marijuana was the center of the stop and frisk dragnetting. That nominally was aimed at collecting guns, but to do that, you were constantly finding marijuana and using it to make stops and to make arrests, because it had this sort of semi-legal in some places territory for a long time. Mullins' instinct to sort of put some of this on Majors was just politically foolish and morally appalling. And I don't say this often, but Bill de Blasio has by far the stronger side of this. The backdrop is that we have a sense that disorder is going up in the city. And some of this is around marijuana. Some of this is around the mentally ill and street homeless population, that often members of which appear to be in our mentally ill. And this is happening without major crime dramatically climbing. So then you have this question of what you want to do about quality of life and disorder for their own sake, if this isn't leading into larger things, if you can't focus just on murderers and really dangerous people and trying to respond to that much smaller group. And there are many people in the business community and in the city at large who really are just much more comfortable having those people pushed out of view. And if that means they end up at Rikers or just smacked around and encouraged to leave the city, are fine with that. And that is the line I think Mullins was trying to advocate for, but just very clumsily and cruelly.
And of course, Christina, Michael Bloomberg just recently apologized in the context of his presidential campaign for his massive stop and frisk policies, having seen, and to his credit, acknowledged, even though it's in this political context, so he's self-interested, but still having acknowledged that the de Blasio policy of pulling so far back on stop and frisk has still resulted in, except for the little uptick this year, crime continuing to go down in the city for these 6 years after Bloomberg left office.
Right. I mean, I think what we've seen is that the stop and frisk strategies of the Bloomberg era just did not work. I mean, what they did was destroy communities, you know, to say nothing about the number of people who ended up in Rikers for no reason, but, you know, the PTSD that so many communities face. I mean, and then also, when you listen to the full Mullins interview, you have to ask yourself, what does he mean by good families? I mean, his vision, his racialized vision of what a city should look like and what equity should look like is just not in lockstep with what I think equality should look like. I mean, and so we disagree on several different factors. But I think what the mayor is saying is that we can actually dedicate resources to communities that make sense, that aren't necessarily based on incarceration and based on, you know, just going into communities and harassing essentially innocent people. And that's what we've seen. And it's unfortunate because every now and again, yes, we have incredibly tragic results. However, in a city of 8.6 million, we have to look at it and say 300-some-odd murders is incredibly small compared to the number of citizens we actually have. And the damage that was done under the Bloomberg era during stop and frisk is something that will take, you know, almost a generation to undo.
Christina Greer and Harry Siegel are co-hosts of the New York City Politics Podcast, FAQ NYC. Christina is also a political science professor at Fordham and frequent guest here and sometimes substitute host for me here. Harry is also a Daily Beast senior editor and a Daily News columnist. His Sunday column in the Daily News about this has a surprise ending. I won't spoil it for you, but it is worth looking up. Harry Siegel in Sunday's Daily News. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The MTA chairman is with us now. One reason is that this week the MTA and its transit workers union came to an agreement during contract negotiations, a move that the MTA says will save the agency $44 million a year. But some estimates are saying it will cost the MTA and maybe riders approximately $350 million over the course of 4 years. So what does it all mean for commuters? Joining me now to talk about the new TWU contract and other MTA matters is Patrick Foy, chairman and CEO of the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority and former director of the Port Authority. He had the pleasure of having to preside over and repair the Bridgegate mess. Welcome to WNYC, Chairman Foy. Thanks so much for coming on.
Brian, thanks for having me on a historic day.
So I see the agreement. Wait, does that mean you want to talk about impeachment?
No. No. Beyond my scope, but I just note it is a historic day.
Historic week because of the contract, no Christmas strike by transit workers?
Exactly. Look, the contract that we struck with the transit workers this week is fair to customers, it's fair to taxpayers, and it's fair to the TWU workforce, which has been a significant part of the success of the Subway Action Plan. We've had 6 months of over 80% on-time performance weekdays. APTA, which is the trade association for mass transit in the United States, just noted that New York City Transit was one of the few agencies in the third quarter that had an increase in ridership, nearly 8%. That's unusual. Long Island Railroad, by the way, was also up over 12%. The successes of fewer major delays, on-time performance up, ridership up. The transit workers have been an important part of that. The contract is first financially responsible. It allows us to live within the envelope of the 2020 financial plan, which our CFO, Bob Foran, presented to the board and the public in November, and which our board will consider and vote on next week, but also the multi-year financial plan. It advances the interests of the system and our customers by availability and overtime reform, accelerating accessibility. The current capital plan, proposed capital plan, is $51.5 billion. New York City Transit will get over $5 billion to increase accessibility at an additional 70 stations and also help advance the goal of reducing fare evasions. On balance, it's a fair deal to customers, taxpayers, and the workforce.
Some of the, I guess, things that are supposed to balance each other out, workers will get a 2% raise. That doesn't seem like a lot, but they're going to have some give backs, like on the health plan, raising the cost of emergency room visits from $0 to $100 and increasing the cost of brand name drugs by $10. So how do you see this as cost benefit both for taxpayers and for the workers?
Well, look, the average arithmetic increase over the 4 years is about 2.3%, slightly higher than that. That is first within the envelope of the 2020 budget and the multi-year financial plan, point one. You're quite right that a significant portion of that increase is going to be offset by the healthcare, prescription drug, and other changes that you mentioned. They'll aggregate $44 million. That's every year. We expect that amount to grow. The, for instance, reforms in accessibility are going to advance the interests of our of the capital plan in making 70 additional stations accessible, but will also advance the interests of the MTA in terms of reducing capital and operating expense on those accessibility investments. The phrase is overused, but I think this is truly a win-win-win for the MTA, for our customers, and for the transit workers.
I want to come back to accessibility in a minute,
sure.
But just to stay on the numbers for another second, Nicole Gelinas, sure, budget wonk at the Manhattan Institute, wrote in the New York Post recently that the first year of this agreement will cost riders and taxpayers about $28 million, the $72 million in raises, minus the $44 million in savings from the union givebacks. So the question is, how will the MTA make up for that other $28 million? Is it through fare increases?
Well, no, we are not assuming any change in fare increases, and the current policy on fare increases is that they be 2% or lower if the rate of inflation is lower, done every 2 years. That is going to continue to be the policy that we're assuming in our financial plan going forward. So this is not being done on the backs of our riders. Rather, what we've done is we have gotten provisions of the contract that allows MTA, New York City Transit, precisely cost to be reduced. That is important. For instance, a 1% increase in wages is about $36 million. As you properly noted, the agreement provides for $44 million annually, and that amount grows, and that helps us control the cost. The first year increase in costs is actually lower than the amount that Nicole Gelinas mentioned. We read her piece with interest, but we think this is a deal, an agreement rather, that's fair to customers, is fair to taxpayers, and it's fair to the TWU workforce.
And from what I read, some budget watchdogs say the contract doesn't do enough to address the MTA's high labor costs. Some people will remember that big New York Times expose from a couple of years ago that showed how expensive it is to lay 1 mile of track in New York compared to other cities. So was it difficult to ask for more concessions from the union, given the governor's closeness with the TWU leadership, or how would you frame it?
Well, look, I think it's fair to say that it was an arduous negotiation. May 15th.
Whoops, your line is breaking up. Are you moving around where you are?
Can you hear me?
Can hear you right this second. Try it again.
Okay. So the contract expired May 15th. The negotiations, I think it's fair to say, were arduous. They went on for several months. Obviously, the TWU was quite vocal about their demands for a contract. So this was a tough negotiation by all measures. The focus on MTA capital construction costs in the New York Times piece that you refer to, I think is important. I think that a number of reforms have been put in place. One is state law has been amended as part of the state budget this year to require all MTA projects above $25 million to be done as design-build projects. That's really best practices around the country and around the world. The MTA has been slow to adopting design-build, and that's now a requirement of state law. Second is there's a new team really throughout the MTA. Jano Lieber, who worked for Silverstein Properties and rebuilding the World Trade Center site after 9/11, is now in charge of construction and development at the MTA. There's a new approach in addition to design-build. We're going to be bundling projects. We're going to have project CEOs. And this is not just something that's aspirational. Let me give you five or six examples of projects under Jano Lieber's leadership and the new team's leadership that have been brought in. Second track on Long Island was brought in about 12 months early. Third track on the Long Island Railroad is ahead of schedule and on budget. Omni, which is the new fare payment system, and we announced that it's being expanded to Penn Station and other stations this month, is a $600 million design build. That project is on time and on budget. We've reported to the board consistently. Central Business District tolling RFP was brought to the board a month early, approved, and the contract signed in October rather than November. And I think your listeners are aware of the progress that's been made on the L train, a better project, a better execution, and right now that project's on time and on budget. So this is not something that is pie in the sky or that we're hoping for. Today, under Jano Lieber's leadership and the new team's leadership, these projects are being brought in on time. There's clearly a lot that has to be done to address those capital construction issues. Most of the, frankly, workforce working on those, TWU plays an important role, but there are non-MTA unions that are part of that. And we've been working with the trade associations for the construction and development industry in the city to be more efficient and more productive with those dollars.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for the MTA CEO and Chairman, Patrick Foy, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The occasion is the agreement with the Transport Workers Union, but we're talking about the MTA generally, which, as you know, has been in crisis, or we've been saying the subways are in crisis over recent years. They are starting to come back. There are also plans to do new things. The Omni payment system is coming online, and there are other things going on. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I want to get to Omni. I want to get to accessibility. But one of the most controversial parts of the operating budget is the plan to hire 500 MTA police, and the MTA reports that would cost $249 million through 2023. How did the MTA come up with that number, 500 officers, and is that really the best way to spend $250 million when we already have the NYPD?
Well, look, the NYPD does have primary responsibility for policing the subways. Here's the way the thought process on the 500 additional MTA police officers. First, there are right now about 80 unfilled vacancies, positions as a result of unfilled positions, vacancies, and attrition. One. Two, every police force experiences retirements when officers reach a 20 or 25-year level of service, and there's retirement. So looking at the 80 unfilled positions, and then in addition, Brian, we have to recognize that the MTA Police Department has a geography that includes the city of New York, subways and buses together with the NYPD, but also includes hundreds of stations of Metro North and Long Island Railroad. As a result, this is a number that we came up with. We believe the additional police officers, I don't see a bifurcation between providing transit and transportation services and policing. We believe that providing a safe and secure environment for our passengers, whether it's on the subways, North Long Island Railroad, is a fundamental part of the service that, that we provide. We expect the additional police officers will help create a safe and secure environment on the areas that they're deployed. Will help reduce police overtime, because some police overtime has been driven by the fact that these 80 unfilled positions exist. We think that overtime will be reduced roughly $100 million over a four-year period, which will obviously cover a large portion of the $240 million increase in costs that you mentioned. They'll help with fare evasion, which is obviously a $300 million a year issue on the subways and buses, and just provide safe and secure environments for our customers on every service that we run.
I've read that the MTA has said it doesn't have a good grasp of the extent of the fare evasion problem, that your surveys are not as scientific as you might hope. Can you confirm that?
Well, look, we have changed the methodology. New York City Transit has changed the methodology of calculating fare evasion this year, and we believe it is more precise. Andy Byford, who's obviously been and doing a great job running New York City Transit and has been involved on the underground in Toronto in Australia, believes that the methodology for calculating fare evasion at New York City Transit is probably among the most precise in the world. We are doing additional work to get a handle on that number, but there's no question that fare evasion is a significant and growing number. We are exploring, with the help of funding from the Manhattan DA's office, new technologies for fare array outlays and for emergency gates and other things, including messaging, to reduce fare evasion. I believe, hard to quantify, that the 7.6% increase that APTA, the trade association, reported for New York City Transit for the third quarter, in part is a result of making progress, and this is hard to make a causal link at this point, but I believe it. But I think we've begun to make progress on the fare evasion issue, but have a lot more work to do.
And one other thing about the officers, I think a lot of people got the impression from the way the governor announced this deployment that this has to do with sweeping homeless people out of the way because other people don't like to see them there. How would you put it?
No, I don't think that's right. I think that NYPD, the MTA Police Department, working with not-for-profits, health and human service not-for-profits in this area, including the city of New York, which has obviously got a statutory responsibility to provide shelter to homeless individuals, that there has been an approach taken. Nobody believes that having homeless people, especially in some of the cold weather days that we've experienced in the last couple of weeks, sleeping on streets or sleeping on subway platforms is a humane thing. And the approach that's been taken has been first and foremost treating the homeless with respect and dignity and taking appropriate steps to get shelter, to provide shelter for them where that's indicated.
Let's take a phone call. Annette,
sure.
In Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with MTA Chairman Patrick Foy. Hi, Annette.
Hi. My concern is access of subways for the disabled. In my area in Washington Heights, there is a big project going underway where elevators are being replaced. However, upon inquiring about that, I find out that the elevators will not provide any extra service to the disabled, so that the disabled person will still have to manage stairs after getting off the elevator, just like in the past. So a lot of money is being spent to replace elevators. I don't know exactly how much, but it's a lot of money. And the disabled will still have no access to the station.
So, Annette, thanks for your question. I think with accessibility on the subway stations, there are two fundamental issues. First, there's not enough accessible stations. We recognize that. The new proposed capital plan for the period 2020 to 2024 provides a record amount of capital for the MTA.
Whoops, we lost you again, Mr. Foy. You there?
Brian?
Yeah, now we got you back.
Yeah, sorry, I've been stationary. So I'm not sure what the problem is. So two issues with accessibility, not enough accessible stations. The new capital plan is a historic amount of money, $51.5 billion. It's subject to approval of the Capital Program Review Board, and $6 billion in funding split between the state and the city for accessibility. New York City Transit, subways and buses, gets a record amount of capital, $37 billion. And of the subway piece, over $5 billion will go to creating 70 new accessible stations, which will achieve the goal of making sure that no customer is more than two stations away from an accessible station. The second issue with accessibility is where there are ADA elevators in place, they don't work frequently enough. And one of the things that was a focus in the labor negotiations, but frankly is a focus throughout the entire MTA, New York City Transit, but the entire agency, is increasing accessibility, subways, Long Island Railroad, and Metro North. And the $5 billion that has been allocated to transit, we believe, is the largest amount that will ever be invested by any agency in one capital plan for accessibility. So there is hope on the horizon. We are committed, and the union is committed as well, to accelerating the investment and the construction and opening of those stations. And I think that this is a landmark in terms of ADA accessibility progress in the city of New York.
But is 70 new accessible stations really a good number? I know there have been surveys that indicate that the New York subway system is really not accessible compared to other major subway systems around the world. There are hundreds of stations. Are 70 new stations with elevators really enough?
Well, 70 is the beginning. This is the first step on making every station in the subways accessible. But clearly, there had been discussion in the last couple of years about an additional 50 on top of the 100-plus stations that are already ADA accessible. 70 is, as I said, the largest investment by any agency ever in ADA accessibility in the United States. When that those funds have been those stations, ADA stations have been construction's been completed and the funds have been spent, there will still be work to do. But no customer will be more than two stations away, and the next capital plan and the capital plan after that will have to build on the progress of the 70 stations. It is an extraordinary amount of investment, and frankly, an amount that I think it's fair to say even the ADA advocates were surprised about the boldness of the number.
Andrew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with MTA Chair Pat Foy. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. I'm a frequent bus rider in Brooklyn. The timetables at the bus stops have disappeared, replaced by a notice to log on to the MTA website for arrival times. Well, believe it or not, not everybody does own a smartphone. Besides, if it's raining, it's snowing, it's merely 20 degrees out, do you really need to pull out your phone and spend time to find out when the bus is arriving? I would love to see these timetables come back. It would be a huge convenience to most people.
Well, look, I will take that request back to Andy Byford. I will note a number of things. There are changes in bus schedules sometimes as a result of, for instance, weather, construction, et cetera, which the printed schedules obviously are not able to take into account because they are printed on a weekly, monthly basis, and those changes can't be contemplated. The bus schedules, in addition, are available not only on smartphones, but iPads, computers, et cetera. Beyond that, the focus on buses is increasing bus speeds. Bus ridership at New York City Transit, but also, frankly, bus agencies throughout the United States has been down over the last 10 years for a variety of reasons. Legislation that was passed at the state level for bus lane camera enforcement, the successful pilot on the 14th Street busway has been an extraordinary thing. And beyond that, the bus redesign that Andy Byford and Craig Cipriano and their teams are involved on a borough by budget borough basis has seen increases in bus speeds. So, in addition to the schedule, we're focused on bus speeds. We're focused on bus lanes not being blocked, which is extraordinarily important. and innovations like the 14th Street busway. I will say that there is about approximately 2,000 new buses that will be bought in the that will be purchased under the new capital plan 2020 to 24, and that will include the largest all-electric bus order in the United States, 500 buses. So on every level, bus service is improving. The bus redesign in the boroughs has been an important part of that, and bus speeds after a prolonged period of time where they have declined and obviously been a contributing factor to the decline in bus ridership. We're fighting against that trend, and that's really good news for bus riders.
What's the latest with Omni, the contactless fare payment system that's supposed to replace the MetroCard and is now available in some places?
So Omni is first on time and on budget. Additional 85 stations are being added before the end of the year. That includes Penn Station. So Omni will be present not only at Grand Central, which it was part of the first 16 station pilot, but Grand Central, but Penn Station as well as South Ferry. The plan, and we will make this, is that by the fourth quarter of next year, Omni will be rolled out to all subway stations and to all bus lines. We started with 16 stations on the subway and the Staten Island Express buses. Omni's been a critical hit. Customers love it. I think customers from well over 100 countries, foreign countries, have used Omni. And we achieved our 4 millionth Omni tap way ahead of schedule. It is really the fundamental premise of Omni is customer choice, so people will be able to continue to use a MetroCard for the next 2 or 3 years to be replaced by an Omni card. The people who want to use cash will be able to do that, but folks will be able to use contactless credit cards, Apple watches or similar devices, and smartphones. And the fundamental principle is customer service, and our customers appear to be loving it.
My understanding is it doesn't yet take the weekly or the monthly or the reduced fare rates by seniors and others, correct?
Yeah, Brian, that is the case. That was the plan from the beginning. The back office for Omni is being built, and when we roll it out to all the subways and buses in the fourth quarter of 2020, by the way, Long Island Railroad and Metro North will follow in the first quarter of 2021, though that back office will have been completed, and people will be able to use those various programs you just mentioned.
We're just about out of time. Let me get you briefly on one thing looking back and one thing looking forward.
Sure.
You were the executive director from the New York side, appointed by Governor Cuomo, of the Port Authority at the time of Bridgegate. For people who don't know how that works, it's a New York, New Jersey jointly run agency. Are there long-term lessons, not just about the scandal of how the lanes were closed, but a lot of stuff was revealed about dysfunction at the Port Authority. What do you think the long-term lessons of that era are?
Look, I think that first, I'm the person that opened the lanes, just for the record, for your listeners who may not know that. I think the indications, or the lessons rather, is that governance is important. The integrity of people who get placed at agencies like that is important. I think, thirdly, that the Port Authority is an extraordinarily important transportation organization for the entire region and, frankly, beyond.
The Bridgegate case is going to the Supreme Court next month. Do you hope for any particular outcome?
Frankly, I didn't know it was going back to the Supreme Court last month. I've, frankly, been following that course case with I've been busy on MTA matters, as you can imagine.
Yes. And any last thing, any
sure.
reason that you would advocate breaking up either of these agencies? Would be better off if the airports were run by something other than the Port Authority? And on the MTA, there are going to be people running for mayor in 2021, I think, who are going to advocate detaching the buses and the subways from the larger MTA, which also runs the commuter rails.
Well, look, I don't work at the Port Authority anymore. I don't think breaking up the Port Authority would be a good idea, but that's not my job anymore. Look, in terms of the breaking up the MTA, I've got a couple of thoughts. One is the MTA is a system, right? People ride the Long Island Railroad to Penn Station or Metro North to Grand Central, when approximately 50% of them get on a subway or bus. And in the evening, the same is true. There are lots of our customers who use multiple services of the MTA. So it's a system, and fragmenting that I don't think is in the interest of our customers or frankly, the regional economy, point one. Point two, I think there are advantages of, for instance, and I think that the historic transformation that is underway at the MTA is an example of this. I think the consolidation of corporate functions at the MTA and, you know, procurement, multiple procurement departments, multiple real estate departments is not ideal. The transformation plan, which was created by Alex Partners and approved by our board in July, I think is a validation of that. So I think further consolidation and transformation and efficiency is exactly the right thing to do. Third, I think there are advantages to scale in terms of financing and other things. And it's only a state authority such as the MTA that is in a position, I believe, to get the extraordinary levels of funding that the governor and the legislature have provided to the MTA over the last several years, including, frankly, the $836 million of aid that originally all came from the state, and then the city contributed its share for the subway action plan, I think was extraordinarily important. So I am, I obviously will look at any proposal that is made, but I'm skeptical about the wisdom of a breakup.
That was a good, thorough answer. You know, I'm going to throw in a last thought, which is that people have a love-hate relationship with mass transit around here, right? We love the fact that we can get around without cars better than any city in America, but then you have to wind up in these positions of running things like the Port Authority and the MTA where, you know, you're doing this hard job and people are going to sneer at you when they know what you do half the time. Even the workers. One of the issues we didn't talk about is that there are assaults on transit workers while they are just down there and out there doing the best they can in the overwhelming number of cases. And why do people assault transit workers? It's absolute madness. So do you want to give us a parting thought on the love-hate relationship that people have with your agencies?
Yeah, let me make two points. One is assaults on transit workers are abhorrent. They are Class D felonies. I think they ought to be prosecuted as such. The TWU has reported a double-digit increase in assaults on transit workers on subways and buses. That's unacceptable. With respect to the love-hate relationship with respect to transit, I'd make the following point. One is ridership on New York City Transit in the third quarter, according to, you know, Independent Trade Association, up 7.6%. And just as importantly, on-time performance above 80% for the sixth month in a row, major declines down. So I think there's reason, and I've been riding the subways since I was 4 years old in Manhattan and Jackson Heights, and I'm aware of the love-hate relationship. But the subways and buses are getting better. Bus speeds are going up. We've got a lot more work to do. The capital plan, the $51.5 billion capital plan for the next 5 years will be an extraordinarily important part of achieving additional progress.
Patrick Foy, Chairman and CEO of the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority, better known as the MTA. Thank you so much. We really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Brian. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now, Jody Rudoran, editor of the Jewish news organization The Forward, with her thoughts on the apparent anti-Semitic terrorist attack in Jersey City last week and on President Trump's executive order declaring Judaism a nationality in the eyes of the U.S. government, not just a religion, as a means of fighting what Trump defines as anti-Semitism on campus. By way of background, Jody Rudoran just recently joined The Forward after 20 years at The New York Times, including a stint as Jerusalem bureau chief from 2012 to 2016. By way of full disclosure, she has an editorial today cautiously supporting Trump's executive order, but urging that it not be used to stifle legitimate criticism of Israel or to embolden right-wing anti-Semites while it cracks down only on others. Hi, Jody. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC, and congratulations on becoming editor of The Forward.
Thanks so much, Brian. It's great to be on your show.
I want to start by saying why you took this job and how you see the forward at 122 years old in today's media and cultural landscape.
Sure. I mean, you know, the Forward has this incredible history, which a lot of your listeners probably know well, of really being the beacon that welcomed generations of immigrants to the Lower East Side. And it was this huge Yiddish institution, at one point had more subscribers than the New York Times. That is very different now. And now it's one of the many really high quality news organizations that are struggling to find a model, a sustainable model for journalism in the digital age. And as I was sitting at the New York Times, where I was increasingly working on audience engagement and digital innovation, I realized that while the New York Times is actually doing quite well in its new model and had, you know, this huge subscription base and huge readership, that it wasn't enough. It's not enough to sustain our democracy to have one or a handful of great news organizations. We need many, and that I saw what was happening at the Forward, where they were really trying to reinvent, and I thought it was a really compelling opportunity. I also feel like while we have kind of this problem of a news desert and of lack of engagement and of really of polarized politics and the kind of filter bubble for the news universe across issues that the Jewish community is suffering particularly and having a lack of a really high quality platform for both information, inquiry, and most importantly, probably civil discourse. And I really thought the Forward could has that role historically and can step into that breach and has an opportunity to become the place where Jews really talk to each other about the tough things that divide us. So,
well, I wish you success at that.
Thanks.
And I summarized your editorial in a couple of lines there. Would you care to elaborate?
Well, first of all, it's important to say it doesn't say that Judaism is a nationality, and certainly not in the modern sense. It's not like you have to choose between being Jewish and being American. I certainly can't imagine making that choice, and it's very clear to me, and I think to the vast majority of American Jews, that our nationality is American. But we are members of a tribe, as I said in the piece, and members of that Judaism is not really also just a religion. I heard you use that phrase, and I agree with that too. It's as much a culture and sort of an ethnicity, a peoplehood, or as I said, a tribe is how we often define it. And I think what the order is, at least says it's trying to do, is to say that when Jews are attacked based on those things, based on their membership in a group, an identity group that is, you know, unchangeable, then that's not okay. That's the same as racism, and it's not okay. And the Trump order is at least purportedly trying to give university administrators more tools to deal with what is a really serious and growing problem. Now, there's a lot of very legitimate criticism of this order, that actually the motivation is just to quash anti-Israel speech in particular, and that Trump is a suspicious character to be trying to deal with anti-Semitism because he's also on this, you know, in the very other breath, seems to be fomenting anti-Semitism. And I share all of those concerns. I just think that it's not automatically bad because Trump said it, and that actually in this case, other Democrats, the Obama administration, had said something very similar. There's bipartisan legislation that had said something very similar, and I think the universities need more tools.
You wrote that you don't believe all anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Speaking for yourself, how do you know the line when you see it?
Oh, such a good question. I mean, I think it's when it's really attacking, especially on college campuses, it's really when it's attacking a person and not what they're saying. Often in this case, it's conflating Jews and Israel. It's blaming all Jews for something that the Israeli government might be doing. It's really broad brushstroking what is happening in Israel and not kind of engaging with its complexity. All those things can be anti-Semitic, I think. I mentioned in the piece something I heard, a woman who was speaking Hebrew, on campus, and somebody said something to her like, you kill Muslim babies. You know, that's not okay. That's a kind of leap that's connecting a person with an identity, with somebody else's policy, and it's exaggerating that policy kind of grossly. It's that's where we start to worry.
It's like when people see someone they think looks identifiably Muslim and they call them a terrorist.
Exactly. Or blame them for some specific terrorist act.
You wrote that you trust the leaders of our great universities where the First Amendment is always first, to err on the side of protecting speech. But why trust them so much if what Trump is doing with this executive order is threatening federal aid?
I mean, it's a good question, and they are under pressure on both sides from this. But I guess what I've just heard from lots of I guess I'll say two things. One is that other than newspaper, news leaders, journalistic leaders, I feel like university leaders, the best of them, are really some of the finest kind of thought leaders we have. And I do generally instinctively trust them. I covered education for a long time, and I just think they're deep commitment to the virtues and opportunities that our university system provides in terms of what the academy should be about, I admire and respect and do trust. They are under a lot of pressure. Obviously, they're under pressure to raise money. They're under pressure to recruit students. And they, I think, are increasingly under pressure to balance people's right to free speech with people's right to safe space. And in this generation, it seems to be particularly difficult. The speech has gotten uglier, and the sort of woke discussion around safe space has gotten kind of more far-reaching, I guess I would say. So they're trying to hold the line, and I do, you know, trust them. And I am hearing that they are worried about the way that criticism of Israel has often going over the line to be anti-Semitic. And so I'm worried about it. I'm hearing from them. I'm hearing from parents of kids all the time, and I'm hearing from kids.
Funny enough, it's more the right these days that criticizes university leaders for censoring speech, right? They claim conservative political opinions are getting banned as hate
That's
speech
right.
too often. I'm curious if you have an opinion on how that right-wing movement complaint intersects with the grievance that many pro-Palestinian rights students must now be feeling.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, I think in the university setting, it's actually easier than in other settings because it's like, okay, this is about freedom. This is about freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and engagement with difficult thoughts. That's what the whole point of being here on this campus is. So the people, I think, are trying to lean over to allow speakers to come to campus and make their speech, to allow the protest, but to find a way for them to coexist. And that seems to be, right. I mean, I think you're right. It would be very interesting if they came into a coalition of some kind of right-wing speaker and the people who are worried about this order because of the want of protecting anti-Israel speech. It would be very interesting if they would get together.
Listeners, my guest, if you're just joining us, is Jody Rudoran, the new editor of the Jewish news organization, The Forward. And we'll open the phones on various aspects of this. Jewish listeners, as a headline in The Forward puts it, Trump aside, do you consider yourself part of a nationality, not just a religion? 212-433-WNYC. Are you experiencing more anti-Semitism, Jewish listeners? Statistically, we know incidents are on the rise for Zionists or anti-Zionists with connections to college campuses today. Also an invitation to call in. For Zionists or anti-Zionists, do you feel you are subject to discrimination or hate speech of any kind or censorship of your speech of any kind? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take a phone call from Steve in Cold Spring. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I am a Jewish American, an American Jew. I have lived in Israel. I'm a former Zionist, and now I'm an anti-Zionist. I support the BDS movement. I support Palestinian rights. But I very much support Israel's right to exist and live a free and democratic life. I think the two will rise together or the two will fall together. And I'm always stunned that people rail against the BDS movement. We had violent terror. And this is an alternative that's peaceful. It's an economic and political protest. But it's a fantastic alternative, and there has to be some way to voice these feelings. So I would suggest that the issue is not, are we a nationality? Are we a religion? We are all of the above, but I think what we need to do is educate people. Young people today view anti-Zionism and blame the Jews, and that's the differentiation that needs to be made between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism.
Steve, thank you very much. And for background for people who don't know, the initials BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. That is, boycott, divest, and sanction Israel as a means of putting economic pressure on Israel, basically to end the occupation of Palestinian lands. So, Jody, you came out against BDS in your editorial in the Forward. What do you say to Steve?
Well, I'm not, I mean, I don't have a position pro or against BDS, but I think, I mean, that's not something, I don't think that was in the piece.
Oh, maybe, I'm sorry.
But that's okay, but I think what's interesting about what Steve said is the way he described himself, I feel like is super resonant with lots of people, and which is, in other words, pro Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state and a Jewish democracy, I think that's what he said, really worried about how it is executing its democracy and how and protecting Palestinian rights in particular, and really compelled by the idea that boycott and divestment and sanctions, small b, small d, small s, are important tools for nonviolent protest as alternatives to violent attack. All of those things, I think, make a lot of sense. Why I think some people are so concerned about the BDS, capital B, capital D, capital S movement is because its founding principles and some of its leadership, really, it's questionable whether those things comport with Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. One of the principles, for example, is a right for all Palestinian refugees to return. If that were to happen, there would be a Palestinian majority in the 1948 borders of Israel. In other words, so there might be a second state, but the 1948 borders, pre-1967, nothing to do with the West Bank, would have a Palestinian majority, so it would be very difficult for it to be a Jewish state and a democracy. So I think that's the concern, is that people think that the leadership of BDS, or that some of its adherents and that its principles actually really call for the destruction of the state of Israel as a Jewish state, or at least for it don't support its right to exist as a Jewish state. And so that's where it gets a little tricky between this official group and the general idea. I certainly agree that civil disobedience, things like boycotts, are absolutely important tools of a democracy and a freedom of expression.
Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. Let me get a speaker here. To the extent that, also turn off the dryer, to the extent that Jews are being discriminated against as if they were a nationality, the Trump statement makes some sense, because you're saying if someone's using a category against you, you're entitled to protection from that discrimination. And it occurred to me that the thing that makes Judaism ambiguous as between being religion and nationality is its concern for generational solidarity, people looking back to their ancestors and thinking about their descendants. And that ties into another category of discrimination, which is generational environmental. It seems to me that the Constitution currently does not define person to include future adults, so they have no standing in court to protest the fact that we're offending them environmentally.
And Alan, I'm gonna leave it there and move on to another caller. I hear your points. Ellie in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellie.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Enjoy your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm certainly very much pro free speech, and it is a concern when there is any sort of executive order which may dampen discourse, civil discourse. As John Stuart Mill says, best way to understand your own position is to engage with the opposing one. However, although I have not personally been affected by discrimination in the recent past, there is always a concern, for myself at least, in engaging with certain ideas or taking certain positions publicly within a discourse, with the concern of how it would fall out, potential upgrades in career or positions if a position is eventually sought out. And we see that all the time currently in the current political atmosphere, where someone's former position, whether it was normal a couple of years ago, or even a mainstream position now that is then used to quote unquote cancel or dox the person. So although we need, free speech is needed in a free society, and certainly one that a democracy where it's for the people by the people, as a culture too, we have to be tolerant of people with other views, whether they are ones that we are uncomfortable with, as well.
Ellie, thank you very much. Jody, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I'm just so glad that Ellie brought up the idea of engaging with ideas that are different from the ones you hold. And I feel like that is, I mean, that's something I'm just totally devoted to. It's one of the main principles of what the Forward is supposed to be about, and we're trying to make it about, and it is about. But it's really the bedrock of what the university experience is, right? Is that you know, you go, you engage, you're challenged, you're exposed to different things in class, in reading, on your dorm hall, if you live in the dorm, through campus activities and through campus speakers. I mean, that is the ideal. And I think what's been happening around the issue of Israel and Palestinian rights and to some extent Jewish identity and for or against whatever, what's been happening is like people aren't engaging. They're shouting past each other. There's this idea of these sort of litmus tests for access to this coalition or to this the student government. If you want to be in student government, you have to do this. And there's protests that are silencing people. And I think that's what I'm concerned about, is that this place where you are supposed to be protected as you engage with ideas different from what you already know, where you come from, and it's really supposed to be all about kids learning to do that thing, to engage across divides. That thing that is so desperately missing from our politics and our discourse right now, that the idea that it would be a challenge at the academy really worries me. So I'm focused on the idea of how do we protect that engagement, the engagement with the people who are different from you, with ideas that challenge you, with provocation. Let's create spaces where we can really do that engagement in a deep and serious way, and nowhere more importantly than on campus.
We have a little time left with Jody Redoran, editor of The Forward, as we talk about President Trump's executive order declaring Judaism a nationality, not just a religion, for purposes of enforcement of the civil rights laws on college campuses, which encompass nationality but not religion per se. We're also going to touch very briefly before we finish on the horrific anti-Semitic attack in Jersey City. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Let's take one more phone call at least. Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Jody Redoran. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. There are a couple of things I wanted to say here. First, I just wanted to say I take exception to two things that your guest said. One is she referred to Jewish people as a tribe. I think that actually is a term that's used in an anti-Semitic way, and I would actually encourage her to refrain to refer to Jews as a tribe. And secondly, she mentioned that she understands that people can be anti-Zionist and still supportive of Israel. And there was one caller who said that earlier. But to be anti-Zionist means you're against the idea that Jews are entitled to self-determination and to a sovereign nation. So it's mutually exclusive. Either you can not say I'm not a Zionist supporter, but to say you're anti-Zionist means you don't think the Jewish people should have a nation. So you're anti-Israel. You're against Israel's existence if you're saying that you're an anti-Zionist, no matter how you want to parse it. Second thing I wanted to say is that with respect to the Trump executive order, I am in no way, shape, or form a Trump supporter. I pretty much despise this administration, and I support free speech. But I think part of the difficulty here is that Jews have never easily fit into a particular category. They are basically the continuation of a civilization that existed over 2,000 years ago in the area that we think of as now, that is now Israel. And so in a sense, they are a nationality that was dispersed. They do have a unique religion that was created by that civilization. They've regarded themselves as a people partly because of themselves regarding themselves as a people, but also because they were never allowed to integrate into other cultures and countries. And so they were kept as outsiders and as a distinct people by those who were against them. They were kept in ghettos, they were kept in restricted areas, they were not allowed to own property, and so forth. So because they never fit easily into any categories, it's really difficult to say, you know, which one of these do they fit in terms of being discriminated against. Notwithstanding that, they have been discriminated against. And finally, and Zionism was a culmination of these 2,000 years of exile and persecution and an inability to integrate into the societies and nations of other countries with the possible exception of the United States. And now finally, because the Palestinian rights movement has unfortunately morphed into a form of Jew hatred and anti-Semitism, that's why there needs to be a pushback. Because, as your guest did rightly say, they're not hearing each other, they're just denigrating each other. And I don't think actually the Jews are denigrating the Palestinians. I think they're actually, most Jewish students are very open to hear about Palestinian rights. It's the Palestinian rights supporters who completely refuse to listen to Jews, to listen to Israel supporters, to listen to anything they have to say, and basically invalidate anything that they want to contribute to the discussion.
Susan, thank you for your call. Jody, I can just hear some of our listeners screaming that a lot of that was true, but a lot of it was also a very one-sided, all good is on one side, all bad is on the other side kind of interpretation of the facts.
Right. I mean, I think Susan sounds like a thoughtful, knowledgeable person, but she definitely is not. I think she's definitely speaking about one narrative. And one of the things about what's so complex about when I was covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is when you have a conflict that's based on narrative and identity, it is very, very difficult for people to understand each other's perspectives and to really engage with the other side. I want to also correct one thing that she said. I did not say that you could be anti-Zionist and pro-Israel or pro-Jewish self-determination. Our caller did describe himself as both anti-Zionist and supportive of the state of Israel as a Jewish state, which to me is a little strange, a little unusual in terms of how the terms are used. And actually, this leads me somewhere else, Brian, which is just
But you did say you could be anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic.
For sure, you can absolutely be anti-Zionist. But my understanding is that the idea of being anti-Zionist is to say Jews do not deserve. It's basically anti-ethnocracy. There are two parts of it. One strain, I think, is saying that, you know, Jews don't need a state, don't deserve a state. They are not an ethnicity or a nationality that deserves a state. They are citizens of other states. And the other is that they can't have the state in this place because there's another people there that has the right to that place, which is the Palestinian people. So I think they're probably both of those things are probably present among anti-Zionists. But it certainly is against the idea of the modern state of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people is what anti-Zionism is. But it leads me actually to a different point that I don't know, I'd be interested in what the listeners' takes are on this, which is that the very term Zionist, and certainly anti-Zionist, but Zionist itself has become so fraught. We have polling that shows that the vast majority of American Jews support the idea of Israel as a Jewish state or Jewish democracy, have favorable views of Israel, although the vast majority are probably also critical of its policy on various things to do with Palestinians. But I'm not sure they would define themselves as Zionist. I think that originally the term Zionism was really about, you know, supporting the idea that there should be a Jewish state, and now I feel like it is much more complicated and fraught. And people, it's really a term that means activist Zionist. I'm like members of, I think in common parlance, people think of it as, oh, no, I'm not, like, marching in parades and protesting and sending money. I just, yeah, sure, Israel should exist. And I think the question of what a Zionist is these days and how many people actually think of themselves as Zionism, and other people think that it's time for post-Zionism, that, you know, Israel was established, it's there, you don't need to be an active Zionist anymore.
We're just about out of time. We're over time. Just tell me briefly what you make of Jersey City, which we talked about at length here last week, but not just as a horrible anti-Semitic mass murder, as an isolated incident, but also as more than that, if you see it that way.
I mean, there's no question, Brian, that in various ways, anti-Semitism is on the rise, and that includes violent attacks of Jews in Jewish places like synagogues in Poway and Pittsburgh, and now this kosher supermarket. It includes violent attacks on visibly Orthodox Jews across Brooklyn virtually every week. It includes vandalism, like the swastikas that were found on the high school in my own town, Montclair, last week, and apparently on a synagogue in Beverly Hills, I think yesterday. It involves all of it. It involves stuff that's going on Twitter. So there's no question in my mind that there's a pattern here, and that it's part actually of a rise in hate crimes generally, although it seems to be maybe the most intense rise. This is, you know, the particulars of every, you know, what makes someone go shoot up any place is always has some, there's always questions about somebody's mental fitness, about their particular motivation, about how desperate they'd become in their own lives to obviously risk their own death. So each incident is obviously very, very complicated. This one involves a group called the Black Hebrew Israelites that is itself very complicated. Their ideology is complicated. So I think, you know, I feel like it's both at once a unique thing that happened to this community, these individuals, you know, Leah Ferenz and Moshe Deutsch and Miguel Douglas, who were killed in the store, and Detective Joseph Seals, who was killed in the cemetery, for their families, for that community. It's the same, whether it's part of a trend or not, right? They're gone. But I think we do need to take that distance and to understand how this fits into how to contextualize it and how it relates to the way that our rhetoric, both rhetoric and access to weapons, has you know, loosened. And more we are seeing people killed with hateful ideologies behind it. It's frightening.
Jody Wadoran, the new editor-in-chief of the Jewish news organization, The Forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.